Well, good evening. Thank you for being here, and thank you to those who make the extra effort to be here. I truly appreciate it, and I'm sure our God in heaven does as well. Last week, we talked about, is it okay to have doubts? A lesson that is rooted deeply within the idea of questions about faith, life, religion, God. And we talked about the fact that we need to fully investigate those things before we can even move on in our lives by having that solid confirmation of why we believe what we believe and why we are here. You know, what's the purpose of our being here, not only here tonight, but I mean, life in general, why do we exist? And so for the next several months, every Sunday night, we're going to be looking at lessons that question those things. You know, why are we here? What's our purpose? What's the meaning to life? Questions that surround faith and life and God. Before we can even begin to talk about religion, before we can even begin to talk about Christianity as a whole, heaven and hell, etc., we have to address the question of, first of all, whether there is a God. I mean, if there is no God, why are we even here? And if we can answer that question, then I think we need to also answer the other one, naturally, then who is that God? And are we serving the right God? And so, hopefully by the end of our lesson tonight, we will have answered both those questions. So we want to begin by assuming that none of us in this audience tonight, and those watching with us, probably don't know who God is. So let's assume that. And then let's ask the question, is there only one true living God? Is there? So let's begin then by talking about the creation narrative. And under that, let's investigate a couple of those major theories related to that. How the world began and what we are doing here. The Big Bang, the evolution, cosmos, mankind. Let's answer that question under, is there a God? Is there a God? Those who would argue against the existence of a God, gods, or divine being of some sorts, often resort to the Big Bang theory, which is an evolutionary argument to explain the existence of all life and matter as we know it and as we see it. And according to an article on space.com, Elizabeth Howell says, the Big Bang Theory is the leading explanation. Listen to that. It is the leading explanation about how the universe began. It's the leading explanation. Okay, if it's the leading explanation, then obviously in our minds we're thinking there's got to be some traction to that. I mean, if it's the leading explanation among the people of this world as to why the universe began, there has to be something in there that we say, ooh, yeah, that is it. That is why we're here. So we're going to look at that. The argument of the Big Bang goes like this. 15 billion years ago, the universe began with an unimaginable bright flash of energy from an infinitesimally small point. And what that word infinitesimally means is something so small that it cannot even be measured. Such a tiny dot in somewhere in outer space in the galaxies beyond what we can see. This bright flash of energy suddenly came out of nowhere and the world as we know it existed. 15 billion years ago. Which, by the way, if you look at the different theories of the Big Bang, you'll get some scientists that say 20 billion, 10 billion, 5 billion. I mean, the numbers really don't match up, but that's not the point. The point is, billions and billions of years ago, this happened. The world just suddenly popped out of nowhere. That's the idea, and that's what the Big Bang is. Remember, this is the leading explanation as to how the universe began. Keep that in mind. Now, Stephen Hawking, renowned physicist and atheist, he recently just passed away, in 1996, in his book, The Nature of Time and Space, said this, almost everyone now believes that the universe and time itself had a beginning at the Big Bang. I want to show you something in this statement. there is a beginning. And I like this because this is going to help our argument for this later on. But Stephen Hawking says there is a beginning. And in his book, The Reason for God, which, let me take that off on a side point. I would encourage you to pick that book up. It's like $15 on Amazon or online. The Reason for God, pick up a copy of that book. I don't agree with everything Tim Keller says in there, but it's a really good book. And he says a lot of good stuff in there. But here he says, no one can deny that there is a beginning to that which we see and interact with. I mean, we look at something and we know there's a cause to that, right? We look at a suit, clothing, we know somebody made that. Shoes, cars, etc., etc. We know there was somebody behind that. Well, the question then is, why is there something rather than nothing? We know we're here. We know the world began at some point. Why is the natural question. Curiosity peaks at that question. Why are we here? Why did the world begin to begin with? And so we have to answer that. Francis Collins is a scientist who did research as it pertains to genetics and the human genome. He doesn't particularly hold a certain view, but he writes objectively speaking. And in his book entitled The Language of God, here's what he said. I can't imagine how nature, in this case the universe, could have created itself. And the very fact that the universe had a beginning implies that someone was able to begin it. And that someone, seems to me, had to be outside of nature. Now he's writing from an objective point of view. He has investigated the human genetics, the human genome, what makes us up as human beings. And so he says, if there is a beginning, which nobody will deny, Stephen Hawking said it, there is a beginning, nobody denies that, then who is that beginning? I mean, where is that beginning? So scientists go back to the Big Bang and they say, well, it's just a Big Bang. From a small dot somewhere in outer space, 15 billion, 20 billion, whatever the case is, years and years ago, it just happened. Things came together, it was perfect enough, and there's the world. But the problem with that is that when we say something exists, something as perfect, and I'm going to show you that in a second, something as powerful and amazing as our universe, that to me implies a couple things. There was purpose in that. There is power and control behind that. Well, let's imagine there was a Big Bang. Let's imagine 15 billion years ago, the world just happened to appear. Where did it come from? Where was the power and control behind it? The scientists can't find an explanation for that, you see? But where do we get an explanation for that? Well, this is where the Bible comes into play. In Genesis 1 and 2, the Bible asserts that God purposefully and intelligently created the world and everything that lives in it. In Genesis chapter 1 and verse 1, in the beginning God created the heavens and the earth. The earth was formless and void. Darkness was over the face of the deep, and the Spirit of God was moving over the surface of the waters. You know what that's saying, right? In the beginning there was nothing. And then God said, let there be something. Purpose, control, power. Now you put those two arguments together in your mind and you tell me right now which one makes more sense. But, you know, scientists, evolutionists, and atheists who say the Big Bang is the cause, you know, things just happen. Well, imagine you and a friend are walking by a nice house, a nice mansion somewhere, and he says to you, you know, that's a nice house. 50 years ago, everything was just right in the atmosphere. That concrete fell from the sky. It just settled itself. And bricks just began to build one another on top of each other. And the roof just came on by itself. And it just happened by accident. It was a mistake. I mean, if you're a good friend to that person, you immediately call the nearest psych ward. Because they're crazy. I mean, nobody accepts that. A house doesn't just create itself. a vehicle out there just doesn't create itself. Now we understand that there are plants. There are people behind these things. An architect that carefully designs it intelligently. But yet we look up at the cosmos and the universe and we say, no, it all happened by mistake. It's all an accident. Well, how do we accept that? Except if everything had a purpose to begin with. In Psalm 19, verse 1, the Bible says the heavens are telling of the glory of God, and their expanse is declaring the work of His hands. In Hebrews 11, verse 3, by faith we understand that the worlds were prepared by the Word of God, so that what is seen was not made out of the things which are visible. And I would argue that faith plays an important part here. But so would the atheists. Faith does play an important part. Nobody denies that. But the problem is it takes more faith to believe in what they do than what the evidence itself provides. Let me show you what I'm talking about. Now, picture a work of art. Michelangelo's Sistine Chapel painting. Those of you that are familiar with artwork know what I'm talking about. Sistine Chapel painting is a picture of Adam at creation and then every single other person branching off from Adam. Now the atheist and the evolutionist or even the skeptic walks into that place. They look up at the ceiling and they don't dare say, well, years and years ago, conditions were just right so that out of nothing that was there. No, they understand, even though they weren't living at the time of Michelangelo, that he took his time with his talent, some paint and a brush, and he painted that artwork. Or we look at Leonardo da Vinci's The Mona Lisa in the Louvre Museum in France. Nobody there says, oh, that just came out of nowhere. No, we understand there was a creator. We weren't there when it was being done, but yet they can take that at faith. This is the atheist and the evolutionist and the skeptic. They won't argue against that. There's no argument there. We all agree on that. But let's put the world into that argument. Let's put creation, let's put mankind into that argument. Then logic goes out the window. It was all there by an accident or a mistake. Just a tragic misstep in evolution. I mean, that doesn't even make sense. No, they know that there was an intelligent designer behind those things that they saw, even though they weren't in the room. They take that on faith. But for us to believe that somehow 15 billion years ago, from some dot, the world began, and it was a mistake, an accident, I mean, it takes a lot of faith to believe that compared to what we have around us. I mean, do we walk up to a tree with our kids in the park, in a state park somewhere, and do we say, well, you know, son, this just came about years and years ago. I can't explain to you, but it just popped out of thin air. I mean, nobody does that, right? But yet we get up in the television and we write books and we see people on air talking about the foolishness of God creating the world. You know, there are various constants in the realm of physics existing having precise values. And I know this, and this is why I appreciate my science background. I studied science for a while. In an interview, Francis Collins, remember Francis Collins, the genetics guy? Here's what he says. If any of these constants, and what do we mean by that? The speed of light, gravity, those types of things. If any one of those constants was off by even one part in a million, or in some cases by one part in a million million, I mean, that's a really tiny room for error, the universe could not have actually come to the point where we see it. Matter would not have been able to coalesce. There would have been no galaxies, stars, planets, or people. I mean, this is an objective person. He walks into the room, the atheists on this side, the Christians on this side, they argue creation versus the Big Bang. And he looks at it objectively and he says, listen, there are these constants. Explain this to me. I mean, even Albert Einstein, while he did not hold a view to the Almighty God, said, there is no way, there is absolutely no way I would accept that these things came into being without a creator, an intelligent designer, Why? Because we don't accept that with anything else outside of the world and the cosmos. So why would we dare to think that the world and man and everything in it was an accident? When the tiniest little objects out there, like toys and Christmas trees and cars and whatever, books, we know they have a creator. Do you see how the logic falls apart? But here's the clincher now. Remember Stephen Hawking? He said, there was a beginning of the Big Bang. Later, he looked at his argument and he said this: the odds against a universe like ours emerging out of something like the Big Bang are enormous. So he says, you know, I thought about it and I realized it's kind of far-fetched. And I think there are clearly religious implications. He died not holding a view to the Almighty God, but he said, I think there's something religious behind it. What that force is, I don't know. Elsewhere, he says in an interview, it would be very difficult to explain why the universe would have begun in just this way, except as the act of a God who intended to create beings like us. And lo and behold, Genesis 1 verse 26 says, God said, let us make man in our own image. And he did. He said, let there be light, and there was light. And he made the sun and the moon and the stars, and he framed the constellations where there are in the cosmos. Yes, maybe there was a big bang, but God was behind it. And even if there wasn't a big bang, God was still behind it. His fingerprints are seen clearly in the work that we have all over the place. I mean, we look up at the stars. Look at this picture behind me. I mean, look at that. We look at that and we marvel. How could that come about by accident? The fact that Earth exists on an axis that if it were tilted just by 1 degree, we would all be dead in less than 2 seconds. Do you take that on faith, that that's a mistake? I mean, can you go to bed at night thinking that's a mistake? I can't. There has to be some power, some almighty creator behind that, so the evidence speaks for itself. In Romans chapter 1, that's exactly what God says, that the invisible attributes are clearly seen in the things that he has made. I don't have to be physically there, but you know it was made by me. Just like we know the Sistine Chapel painting was done by Michelangelo, or in the Mona Lisa was done by Leonardo da Vinci. So at the very least, we know there's a spiritual being, right? At the very least, we know there has to be a God somewhere out there. So then the question is, who is this person? Who is this God? Who is this spiritual being? And for that, we need to argue about God's assertive role in his creation. And I will argue that Yahweh is God. There's only one. His name is Yahweh. And Exodus is where I need you to be for that. The argument for divine creator would be somewhat weak, and it could be easily dismissed if it were not for the overwhelming evidence, and I mean overwhelming, that he is active in his creation. He is alive and well. In other words, God didn't just create the earth and went away and hid himself. He's not hibernating somewhere till the end of time. He is active and well in his creation. There are several very important examples and amazing examples we can use to show this in the Bible. But we're going to use just one. And that, my friends, is the 10 plagues in Egypt. 10 plagues in Egypt. And I'll tell you the reason why I'm using that. It's particularly strong because it shows us that God didn't just create, but that he's active and he's a sustainer. So what's the context? Well, you know, when Genesis ends, the people are in Egypt. And they're thriving in Egypt. But that doesn't last for long because Pharaoh, a new Pharaoh, arises. And he sees that the Israelites are too much. And so he makes them slaves. He has the power to do that. And he makes them slaves to build great cities for himself. And God realizes that he's going to have to deliver his people, and he chooses a man by the name of Moses. A nobody, by the way. He chooses Moses, and in Exodus chapter 5, Moses and Aaron go to Pharaoh. And here's what the text says. Afterward, Moses and Aaron came and said to Pharaoh, "Thus says the Lord, the God of Israel, let my people go, that they may celebrate a feast to me in the wilderness." But Pharaoh said, "Who is Yahweh?" And that's the exact word he uses. Who is Yahweh that I should obey his voice and let Israel go? I do not know Yahweh. And besides, I will not let Israel go. The Egyptians were well known for their plethora of gods. They were well known for serving other idols and other so-called gods. So when Pharaoh says, "I don't know Yahweh," he is right. He doesn't know Yahweh. But not only does he downplay it, he says, "Your God doesn't have any power over me. I don't know him, and besides, he can't do anything." Which, by the way, we're going to see in a second, Pharaoh himself was considered among the chief gods. Pharaoh himself was worshipped as a god. So God, Yahweh's response, I'm going to use Yahweh. Yahweh's response to this is he says, "I'm going to send 10 plagues. In Exodus chapter 12, verse 12, "I will go through the land of Egypt, and I will strike down all the firstborn, and against all the gods of Egypt I will execute judgment." Why? "So that they will know I am Yahweh." So that they will know what? That I am the only God, and I am alive, and I am true, and I am faithful, and I can execute these things better than any other so-called God can. And that's exactly what he does. And the 10 plagues begin with the river of the Nile turning to blood. Frogs and gnats and insects, livestock of the Egyptians all die. Boils come upon the people, hail fall from the heavens, locusts and darkness so thick that they could feel it. And finally, the death of the Egyptian firstborn. Now, if you look in your outlines towards the back, your last page is a list of those 10 plagues. And corresponding to those 10 plagues is the individual Egyptian gods that would have been thought to have been in control of those things, okay? You'll find that in that list. Now, if you're an Egyptian, you have faith and you have trust that these gods are going to fight against Yahweh. If he's nobody, they're going to win, right? But that's not what happens. God's assertive role falls into place. And exactly as he says, it comes true. And they can't do anything to reverse it. So what God is doing is he's not only asserting himself, but he's executing judgment against their own gods, showing them that they are nothing. And they aren't alive as he is alive. They aren't as powerful as he is powerful. And they don't have the ability to rule in creation like he does. So you walk away from that, and what do you think and what do you believe? There is only one God. His name is Yahweh. That's the point of the 10 plagues in Egypt. And what a point it is. So is there a God? There sure is. What is his name? His name is Yahweh, Jehovah. And there's only one of him. Over and over again in the Old Testament, he does this. And again, we can use several examples, but nothing more over-emphasizing and all-encompassing like the 10 plagues. Is the creation narrative the only evidence that we have? No, let's continue. Talk about the innate desires of man. I like this one. Let me say this. If there is no God, if there's nothing after death, and I have neither to hope for good or to fear for evil, and I am just a byproduct of some accident, and I am a tragic misstep in the evolutionary process, which the atheist and the evolutionist will argue, then I have to face the reality that my life is worth nothing and I'm meaningless. So why not just do whatever I want with impunity? Why not just go out and commit suicide if my life is worth nothing and it's meaningless and I'm just a mistake? But we don't accept that, do we? I mean, to begin to even to talk about something like that is appalling. But yet that's what they argue. Something or someone moves something in man that we should seek satisfaction. We seek a desire in life. You know, somebody might say, I'm destined for greatness. Well, how do you know if you're some mistake or you're some accident? How do you know that's just not your accident speaking or your mistake just coming out all of a sudden? We don't accept that. I mean, even the tiniest child, as he's growing up, maybe he's looking across the street at the garbage man and he says, maybe I want to be a garbage man when I grow up. Or he sees on the TV a policeman saving the day or a firefighter and they say, I want to be that person. That's satisfaction and meaning. And no parent dares to say to their child, you're a mistake. You're a tragic misstep in evolution. No. Our desires and our need for satisfaction points that there's something beyond us. In Ecclesiastes chapter 3, verse 11, Solomon says, God has set eternity in our hearts. He has made everything appropriate in its time. He has also set eternity in their heart. Yet so that man will not find out the work which God has done from the beginning even to the end. You know, we spend our whole lives looking for things that this world will never satisfy. To a certain extent, we get satisfaction, right? Why do we hunger? Because we want food. Why do we thirst? Because we want water. Why do we want adventure? Because we want to go on a trip. We want to go vacationing. We want to do things like this. I'm destined for greatness implies meaning. Meaning implies purpose, which points us to intelligence. Tim Keller says, we have a longing for joy, love, and beauty that no amount or quality of food, sex, friendship, success, money, or wisdom can satisfy. We not only feel the reality, but also the absence of what we long for. And isn't that the truth? We feel that God is somehow near to us. We feel that there is some external power behind these things. But we also feel far away from it at times. Why? Because God has put eternity in the heart of man. The infallible desires that we all seek to serve, to show that God exists, but also there's only one true living God. And what do I mean by that? The fact that we all seek the same thing, which is satisfaction. Well, we seek it in different ways. Somebody might want to be an actor. Somebody wants to be a policeman, a firefighter, whatever the case might be, a businessman. It's all a way of seeking the same thing, which is satisfaction. And you know as much as I do that a creator, an intelligent designer, often leaves hints in its creation of who made it. You know what our hint is? The desire for something more than ourselves. That's God's way of saying, I made you and you have no excuse because there it is, you are seeking for something beyond yourself. In Acts chapter 17, that's what Paul says to the Greek people. He says, God has made from one man every nation of the earth to dwell on the face of the earth. And that we would what? Seek God in the hope that we might find him. When Paul goes to Athens, he sees these people in chaos and confusion. And what they're doing is they're trying to look for a God. They're trying to look for something beyond themselves. And Paul says, he ain't here, people. He's up there. But you know there's something better than you. So let me tell you about who he is. And Paul does. Our desires and our need for something more shows that there is God, but not only that there's only one creator. I mean, if there were multiple creators, think about this, then we would always be in confusion and chaos about something. We wouldn't necessarily be seeking satisfaction altogether, would we? No. Every single human being, there are some exceptions, obviously, grows up in life and their desires to do something, to seek something, to find a meaning. I mean, there are people in this life that just spend their entire life looking for, who am I? What am I? Meaning. Doesn't that show God exists and there's only one of Him? What about the moral obligation? And if there is a clincher to this argument, it has to be this. What about the moral obligation of human beings? I mean, if it were true that human beings were an accident and that all morals are relative, and by that I mean your morals is just as good as mine, then why do we hold a high standard for stuff like murder or stealing or adultery, racial discrimination? I mean, why do we have protesters on the streets of our nation's capital protesting stuff like this if morals are relative and we're just a tragic misstep in the evolutionary process? Why can't we do whatever we want? Why can't we break into people's homes whenever we want? Even Richard Dawkins, a renowned atheist, who would say there is no morals, there is no God, and we are capable of doing whatever we want on our own. If somebody were to break into his home, you know what he would do? He'd call the cops. Why? Because he finds that wrong. And I see Miss Rita laughing because it's true. It's laughable. How do we say and there say in a book, which he writes a book called The God Delusion, that there's no such thing as morals because there's no such thing as God and we can't hold ourselves to a higher standard? But I'll tell you, if you call him a certain word or you go into his house without his permission, he is calling the cops on you. And he's going to take you to court and sue you and get justice. But yet there's no morals, right? You see the logic people use? I mean, there's the evidence. Which one are you going to be on? Which side do you choose? All human beings have morals, whether we realize it or not. Where does it come from is another question. Let me share with you two examples of that. So those who would say morals are just a way of survival. In other words, years and years ago, our ancestors, as they were trying to figure out their lives, because they were all mistakes and accidents, they stumbled upon the idea of doing good. Because doing good somehow made them survive more than other beings, such as animals. Okay. But if you were to walk down by a bridge or a river or the ocean or whatever the case, and you see somebody drowning, your first instinct isn't to say, okay, brain, is that my way of surviving? To jump in the river to save that person? No. Your brain kicks into the reality that you need to save that person. Why? Because if you don't do it, you feel that it's what? Wrong. Right and wrong. You don't even have to think about it. It's an instinct. You go right to it and you do it. Even if it was an enemy, you do that. So the evolution argument that somehow it's our brain's way of saying it's our survival makes no sense whatsoever. Because if we find ourselves in that situation, the brain doesn't say it's for your own survival. No, it says it's for their well-being. It's for their good, right, and wrong. But some people say it's cultural relativism, which means that our morals are just what we learn in culture. You know, if we're an African society, what we do there is just because of what we learn there. And our morals there doesn't affect our morals in Western culture. So, for example, if they find murder right over there and murder is wrong over here, it doesn't matter because that's their morals and this is their morals. But if that were true, why do we lament at the fact of things like world war and racial discrimination and violence and women's rights? I mean, why do we take it a step further if we say it's just culture and morals just come from our culture? No, but embedded with every human, I mean, right-thinking humans, and there is exceptions to that, obviously, people who can't mentally capacitate right from wrong, But they look at the television and they look at news and we see stuff like people dying in the world. And we feel bad about that. Do we even think about that? No, it's an instinct. We jump at it. Where does that come from? Well, remember in Genesis 1:26, God said, "Let us make man in our image." And God has the ability to what? He's a free moral agent. God is a moral being, right and wrong. He judges accordingly, right and wrong. If there is no God, then there cannot be a standard to which we hold one another accountable and to which we hold ourselves accountable. Morals would have to be self-made, which would mean chaos. I mean, if I find murder right and you find it wrong, you know, what's to stop anything from taking place? If we didn't have a judicial system that was modeled off, by the way, of God's system, how would we ever hold serial killers accountable? I mean, we could just put on the television and that'd be just another day in this world. But we don't accept that, do we? We don't swallow that. We dare not even approach an idea like that. But if we're using the evolutionist argument, that's the result. But if we're using the biblical argument, we're free moral agents. What does the evidence show? And yet, even though we hold to a higher standard of morality beyond ourselves, here's the clincher, we just don't accept the gods that say, disregard all human life. You know, we look at people in the East, and they serve gods that say, kill other people. We don't accept that. Most human beings don't accept that idea. So if there is a God, who is that God? Well, it's certainly not the God that says, go kill your fellow human beings. Go offer child sacrifices. And we see that in the Old Testament. Those aren't gods at all. Those are self-depraved men seeking to satisfy themselves with sin. That's not Yahweh. Yahweh says, I value human life. How do we know that? Because he himself left the glories of heaven and became man in the flesh to die for sinful man. That's how we know that. Jesus became himself Yahweh on this earth in the flesh. And he was a free moral agent. He was tempted to do wrong, but he did what was right. He exercised the ability to think and reason just like we can. And if we can see that in this, then my friends, we've just proved that God exists and his name is Yahweh. And Jesus is Yahweh. Because in the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth. And Jesus was there, according to John chapter 1. Without him, nothing was made that was made. And there'll be a separate lesson on proving the deity of Jesus Christ, by the way, later on. But this lesson, I hope, has shown you that there is a God. There is a being and a divine being behind all these things. And his name is Yahweh. His name is Jehovah. So when it's all said and done, the evidence shows us four things. Number one, God is the creator and sustainer of all matter and life. You put it together. What's easier to digest? The fact that there is a God upholding the earth as we speak? Or that somehow 15 billion years ago, everything came from one tiny dot in the atmosphere by accident? I mean, do you accept the fact that you are just a mistake? You know, we don't go to dates, first dates, a man and a woman across from each other at the dinner table and say, you know, I look at you and I think, what a great mistake you are. Exactly. It's a laughable thing. We just don't do that. Why? Because we believe there's meaning there. We believe there's love and joy to be had from that. And friends, that can only come from God. Even the atheist does that. He sits across the table from a beautiful woman. He doesn't look at her and say the very things he argues. No, he says, I value who you are, and I want to spend the rest of my life with you. Not because you're a mistake, but because you were created with meaning. Amazing, isn't it? Yahweh is God, and he is active in his creation. He was active from the beginning and he's active even now. Does it take faith to believe that? It does. But the evidence is there to support our faith far more than it is to support the idea of several other gods upholding things. I mean, you just asked the Egyptians how that ended up. Man's desires point to a single creator. The fact that we all seek for the same thing in life shows us that we were embedded with a purpose. We were all embedded to go in one direction. You know, man and a woman, they grow up, and what did they desire? Love, relationships, meaning in life, kids, cars, adventure. All these things, every single person does it. We might do it in a different way, but we're all essentially seeking the same thing, and that all comes full circle to God Almighty. And finally, our moral obligation is directly associated with God and being created in His image. I mean, that's who He is, and that's why we are here. We are free moral agents capable of making right and wrong decisions. And He wants us to choose to make the right decisions, just as Jesus Christ chose to make the right decisions. So I want to encourage you to think about these things. And hopefully this is able to show you and with your outlines that why you are here is important. And I hope that this strengthens your belief in God even more. And maybe there's a friend in your life who struggles with this, whether there is a God, whether there isn't a God. Show him the evidence for himself. Let him see it. I mean, we walk away from this and deny it, that's on us. But if we've seen the evidence, it's overwhelming. God does exist, and He is alive and well. If we can help you tonight to put Christ on in baptism, knowing that He is alive, He is well, and that He loves you and values your soul, then let's trust in Him to do what's necessary. Let's trust in Him to be the master and ruler of our lives as we stand and as we sing.